If she didn't at least search the place, she couldn't think of staying. She thanked Mr. Armstrong and offered him a diet soda. He seized the opportunity for a chat, and an hour later was still there. She was in no hurry to be alone. When he finally left, she sat in the den and tried to collect her thoughts. A plank popped in the attic, and she jumped out of her skin. As her heart raced and her breathing intensified, she listened for another sound. Could it be a footstep? But there was nothing but silence. She made up her mind to leave and quickly changed into jeans. What to pack? If they were watching and she left with a piece of luggage, her plans would be obvious. She could wait until dark and sneak a bag to her car, maybe two. But she had no desire to be in the house after dark. She took her bulkiest purse and packed it with toiletries and underwear. She filled a paper grocery sack with an empty gym bag and two changes of clothing. There were stores in the area. She could always buy what she needed. As she drove away, she waved at Mr. Armstrong and wondered when she might return. She drove south to the beaches, turned west on Highway 98, and drifted with the traffic along the coast, through seaside communities, and along the occasional stretch of untouched shoreline. As she drove, she tried to watch everything behind her, but soon gave up. If they wanted to track her across the country, how was she supposed to stop them? She filled up with gas in Destin and kept going, soon skirting around Pensacola on smaller roads. When she realized she was in Alabama, she turned east and made a long loop back to Interstate 10. At dark, she stopped at a motel and paid cash for a room. Jo Helen had never spoken to Greg Myers. She knew his name, but he knew nothing about her. Through Cooley, she had received a copy of the complaint filed against her boss by Myers. He was willing to run the risk of exposing the corruption for a slice of the pie, though none of the three, Myers, Cooley, Jo Helen, had any conceivable idea of when the whistleblower claim would be filed. Myers, the lawyer and accuser, was to spearhead the legal efforts to claim the money. Cooley, the ex-lawyer, would handle Myers and Jo Helen and facilitate matters for a healthy cut. Same for Myers. She would get the rest. The deal was nice and tidy and looked good in theory. Now Myers was presumed dead. Cooley had cracked up and fled. And Jo Helen Hooper was hiding in a cheap motel, staring at a disposable prepaid cell phone with only one number to call. There was no one else. It was almost 10 p.m. when she said, "Ms. Stoltz, my name is Jo Helen Hooper. Cooley gave me your number. You remember him?"
"Yes."
"And this is the phone he gave you?"
"Yes. You're the informant."
"That's me. The mole, the source, the informant. Actually, Cooley said Myers liked to refer to me as the whistler because I'm supposed to blow the whistle on Judge McDover. What do you know about me?"
"Nothing. Didn't even know you were a woman."
"Why are you calling me?" "Because Cooley gave me your number, said you had a burner, said to call you if things got bad and I got scared. Well, I'm scared."
"Where's Cooley?"
"Don't know. He cracked up and ran away. Said he was leaving the country before DuBose found him. He found Myers, you know. I have no one else to talk to."
"Okay, let's talk.
How do you know Judge McDover?" "I've been her court reporter for the past 8 years, but that's another story for another day. While we were in court today, a man broke into my home and went through every inch of the place. I know this because I have hidden cameras in my home with an app that allows real-time surveillance on my phone. He took nothing because he wasn't a thief. He found nothing because I do not keep sensitive stuff at home for obvious reasons. Cooley and I started planning this little adventure years ago, and we've been very cautious.
So he added home security, the burners, the off-site storage of records, and a lot of other protective measures and habits.
Does anyone else live there?
Oh, no. I'm single, divorced, no kids.
Any idea who your visitor was?
None. But I would recognize him, I think. Though I doubt I'll get the chance. I'm sure he works for DuBose in some capacity. And I suspect they're closing in on me. The information I gave Cooley and Myers about Claudia could come from only a small number of people. I'm on the list. I'm sorry about your friend.
Thanks.
I'm serious. He would be alive if I hadn't decided to bring down the judge.
Why are you bringing down the judge?
It's another story. Let's save it for later. Right now, I need advice, and I have no one else to turn to. I'm hiding in a motel because I could not stay at home tonight. I'm not sure about tomorrow. If I don't show up for work, warning bells go off. I haven't missed many days in 8 years, and Claudia is already suspicious. If I go to work, I run the risk of walking back to her turf, and that makes me nervous. What if they, whoever the hell they are, have made the decision that I need to go? I'm a sitting duck at work, or going or coming. You know how dangerous the roads can be.
Call in sick. A stomach virus that's highly contagious. Happens to everyone. Jo Helen smiled.
So simple. Why hadn't she thought of it?
Perhaps because her mind was spinning and nothing was clear.
Maybe. But what do I do tomorrow?
Keep moving around.
Did you know that Cooley hid a tracking device on the inside of Claudia's car? He paid $300 for it, and it took him about a minute to install. Said it was a piece of cake. Did you know about that?
We knew that she was being tracked, yes. Didn't know who or how.
My point is that it's easy to follow people, so moving around is not the answer. They can bug my car, hack my cell phone, who knows what else. DuBose has the money to buy what it takes. I'm feeling pretty vulnerable right now, Ms. Stoltz.
Call me Lacey. Is there a bar in the motel?
I think so.
Go hang out in the bar until it closes. If an incredibly handsome young man with a flat stomach hits on you, take him back to your room for the night. If you don't get lucky, get in your car and find an all-night diner, maybe a truck stop. Kill a few hours. If the motel has a night clerk, hang out in the lobby until sunrise. Call me then.
I can do that.
Just stay around other people.
Thanks, Lacey.
Chapter 37. As instructed, Clyde met Hank Scully at a sprawling construction site 2 miles west of Panama City and a mile north of the Gulf. Huge signs announced the arrival of Honey Grove, a planned community with lovely homes, fantastic shopping, golf galore, all just minutes from the Emerald Coast. In the distance, bulldozers leveled a forest. Closer, crews were putting in curbs and gutters. And near the main road, homes were going up. Clyde parked his car and took a seat in Hank's black Mercedes SUV. They rode along one of the few paved streets, weaving around dozens of contractors' trucks and vans parked haphazardly on dirt lots. Hundreds of workers hustled about. Toward the end of the street, the homes were almost finished, and at the very end were 3 spanking new model homes being used to entice buyers. Hank parked in one of the driveways, and they went inside. The carport door was unlocked. The house was empty of people and furniture.
"Follow me," Hank said, and they climbed the stairs.
Von DuBose was waiting in the empty master bedroom. He was looking out a front window, as if admiring the frenzy of yet another scorched earth development. They spoke, shook hands,
and Vaughn actually smiled and seemed in good spirits. Clyde had not seen him in over a year, and he had not changed at all. Slim, nice tan, golf shirt and khakis, just another affluent retiree. Vaughn said,
"So, what's on your mind?"
The bug was built into the Timex watch on Clyde's left wrist, a watch identical to the one he'd been wearing for the past 3 years. Clyde had not noticed the watches worn by Hank or Vaughn, and he was almost certain they had paid no attention to his. Men tend not to notice such things. But Pacheco and his technicians were taking no chances. The leather band was tight because of a tiny vibrator on the back facing of the watch. When the van was within range, the facing would vibrate, and Clyde would know they were in business. It was an exact replica of a FedEx delivery van, and it rolled to a stop in front of the house next door. The driver, dressed in official FedEx garb, got out and popped the hood. Some mechanical failure. In the rear was the FBI, Ali Pacheco and three technicians with their gear. When they were within 200 feet of the Timex, they pushed a button and it vibrated. Inside the bedroom, the mic in the watch would pick up a whisper from 30 feet away. The day before, Clyde had spent 4 hours with Ali Pacheco and two other agents rehearsing his role. Now it was time for his big moment. Deliver Von Dubose, and he, Clyde Westbay, would serve a few years and grow old a free man. Clyde began.
"Two things, Vaughn. I can't find Zeke Foreman. I told him to disappear 2 weeks ago and call me every other day. We spoke a few times, then his phone went silent. I think the kid probably just freaked out and ran away."
Vaughn looked at Hank, shrugged, looked at Clyde, and said,
"I know this already."
Clyde, his stomach flipping fast enough to make sounds for the Timex, shuffled his feet and continued.
"Look, Vaughn, this is all my fault, and I'm taking responsibility. It was a stupid mistake on my part, and, well, who knows what might happen."
Vaughn looked at Hank again and said,
"I thought I told you to pass along my displeasure with what happened."
He looked at Clyde and said,
"Sure, it was stupid. But it's done, and I'm over it. It looks like the damage is contained. You just do your job running the hotels, and I'll get other folks for the dirty work." "Thanks, Vaughn," Clyde said. "The other thing is that I just want you to know I'm willing to leave town for a year or so. I think it might be smart if I just, you know, took a trip and vanished until this blows over. You see, Vaughn, my wife and I aren't doing so well these days, and frankly, it's a good time for me to get away from her. We're not giving up, but she's cool if I hit the road for a while."
"Maybe not a bad idea. I'll think about it."
"I mean, that's my face in the video. And I'm not sure what I'll do if some cop shows up at the office asking questions. Makes me kind of nervous, Vaughn. I'd rather just leave for now. I have good people under me, and I'll check in every week. The hotels will be fine."
"Like I said, I'll think about it."
"Okay."
Clyde shrugged as if he had nothing else to say. He took a step toward the door, stopped, and turned toward Vaughn. "Time for the Oscar."
"Look, Vaughn, I gotta tell you, I love my job and I'm proud to be part of your organization. But, well, you mentioned the dirty work and..."
His voice began to break. His words were scratchy.
"Look, Vaughn, I'm just not cut out for that stuff. You know what I mean? I didn't know that guy was going to die. I didn't know it was all... well, you know, planned. Somebody tampered with the seatbelt and the airbag, and the poor guy went flying through the windshield.
You should have seen him, Vaughn.
His face was cut all to hell, blood pouring everywhere, and he was thrashing around.
He looked at me, Vaughn. He gave me this look that said, "Please, please."
I have nightmares about it, Vaughn. I just left him there. I didn't know what I was doing. Somebody should have told me what was going on, Vaughn.
You were told to do a job.
Vaughn growled and took a step closer.
But I didn't know the job involved killing someone.
It's called intimidation, Clyde. That's the name of the game, and that's how I run things. If not for intimidation, I wouldn't be here, and you wouldn't be making a fat salary running my hotels. Sometimes, in this business, you gotta put folks in line. And sometimes these folks understand nothing but intimidation. If you don't want to do it, fine. I guess I misjudged you. Thought you had some balls.
I thought I had some, too. But I lost them when I saw that guy bleeding to death.
That's part of it.
You ever watched someone bleed to death, Vaughn?
Yes.
Vaughn said proudly.
Stupid question.
Anything else?
Vaughn glared at Hank as if to say, get him out of here. Clyde raised his hands in surrender and backed away.
Okay, okay. But I really want to leave for a year. To get away from all this. Please, Vaughn.
I'll think about it.
In the van, Ali Pacheco removed his earphones and smiled at the technicians. He mumbled to himself,
"Beautiful. It's called intimidation, Clyde. That's the name of the game, and that's how I run things."
The FedEx man suddenly found a way to start his van. He drove away just as Clyde and Hank were leaving the model home. Clyde noticed it, but had no idea it was loaded with FBI. Hank said nothing as he weaved through the construction maze. Traffic was blocked by a truck loaded with brick. In front of them, the FedEx van was also waiting. Hank tapped his fingers on the steering wheel and said,
"Wonder what FedEx is doing here. Nobody's moved in yet."
Clyde said,
"I guess they're everywhere."
The Timex vibrated again. Pacheco was close by and saying,
"Keep talking."
Clyde said,
"So, Hank, do you think I was wrong to say what I said to Vaughn about me not wanting to do the dirty work? It wasn't smart. Vaughn despises weak people. You would have been better off saying nothing. You wanted to meet so you could offer to disappear. That was fine. But the chicken shit stuff doesn't sit well with Vaughn."
"I was trying to make the point that I didn't sign on to kill people."
"No, you didn't. But Vaughn thought he saw something in you. So did I. Guess we were wrong."
"And what was that? What did you think you saw?"
"A guy who might enjoy getting his hands dirty."
"Do you?"
"Why don't you shut up, Clyde? You've said enough for one day."
"And so have you," Allie thought as he smiled again. Clyde drove away from Honey Grove and, as directed, returned to the Surfbreaker Hotel in Fort Walton Beach. He checked in with his secretary, made a phone call, and left. Using a rear door near a loading ramp, he walked out of the building and jumped into the rear seat of a gray SUV. Two FBI agents had the front. As they left the Surfbreaker, the driver said over his shoulder,
"Nice work. Pacheco says you were marvelous. Nailed him."
Clyde said nothing. He didn't want to talk or be congratulated. He felt like a worm for ratting on his colleagues, and he knew things would only get worse. He could not begin to contemplate one day walking into a crowded courtroom and narrating the story for the benefit of a jury of the killing of Hugo Hatch, while von Dubose looked down from the defense table. He took off the watch and handed it to the agent in front of him. He said,
"I'm taking a nap. Wake me when we get to Tallahassee."
By 9 a.m. on Friday, Lacey had not heard from Jo Helen, and she was not answering the phone she'd used the night before. Lacey briefed Geismar, and they were concerned. Using an office landline, Lacey called the circuit clerk's office in Sterling, and after being passed around, was informed that Judge McDover was not in the courthouse that morning. She might possibly be presiding over in the town of Ekman. Since there was a chance Jo Helen had gone to work, Lacey called the clerk's office in Ekman, where a girl on the phone said, yes, Her Honor was in the building, but not presiding. There was nothing on the docket. After a few more dead ends, Lacey had no choice but to sit and wait. She returned a call from Gunther and had a pleasant chat. He had nothing planned for the weekend, other than the usual pending deals, and said he might pop down for dinner Saturday night. She promised to call back later. Jo Helen awoke to bright sunshine and a dead phone. The burner, the last one Cooley had given her, was out of juice, and she'd left its charger at home. Using her cell phone, she called Claudia, and rather convincingly went through the upset stomach routine. Claudia seemed somewhat convinced and mildly sympathetic. Fortunately, there was nothing on the docket that day that would require a court reporter. It was not a day off. Jo Helen lived with a permanent backlog of trial transcripts to prepare. She had to have that damned charger, which would necessitate a return home. She had closed the bar down at midnight. The only possible bedtime companion had been a 40-year-old truck driver with a scraggly beard that wiggled all the way down to his ample pot belly. She allowed him to buy her a drink, but had not been remotely tempted to go further. She checked out of the motel at 9 and drove toward the beaches, an hour south and east. Along the way, she repeatedly reminded herself to keep an eye on the rearview mirror, but she was not up to the cloak-and-dagger crap. She parked in her driveway with a knot in her stomach, and told herself she would never be able to live in the house again. Every inch of her private space had been touched and examined by a man with bad intentions. Even if she changed the locks and doubled down on the security, she would never again relax there. Mr. Armstrong was pulling weeds near his front porch, and apparently wanted to flirt some more. She charmed him over with a big smile and said, "Let's have something to drink." He entered the house with her and stood in the door as she disarmed the security. She went to her bedroom, checking every room along the way and talking nonstop, curious about Mrs. Armstrong's shingles and all. She found the charger where she'd left it, on the counter of her bathroom. She plugged it into the burner and returned to the den.
"Where'd you stay last night?"
he asked. He and his wife were infamous for their curiosity and lack of discretion. They monitored things on the street and wanted to know everyone's business. "My sister's," Jo Helen replied, knowing the question was coming.
"Where does she live?"
"Pensacola." With the house apparently safe, she said, "On second thought, let's go have a soda with Gloria."
"Oh, she'd love that."
They sat in the shade of the Armstrongs' back porch and sipped beverages through straws. Fortunately, the shingles were on Gloria's lower back, and a proper viewing would reveal a bit too much skin. Jo Helen was spared the examination.
"You got a clogged drain?"
Mr. Armstrong asked. "Don't think so. Why?"
"That plumber showed up around 9 this morning."
"Plumber?" Jo Helen quickly decided not to worry them. She said, "Got a leak, but he was supposed to come Monday."
"Pushy guy, I'll tell you that. Wouldn't trust him if I were you."
"Why not?"
"Well, I watched him go to the door and ring the bell.
Then he started fiddling with the door, you know? He even reached into his pocket and pulled out a blade of some sort, like he was breaking in. Hope you don't mind, but I yelled at him and went over, asked what the hell he was doing. He stuck the blade or whatever it was back in his pocket and tried to act like it was nothing. I said you were not home. He mumbled something about coming back later and couldn't wait to get out of here. Me? I'd find me another plumber. I swear he was suspicious.
You just can't trust anybody these days, Jo Helen said, and returned to the shingles, a subject Gloria was keen to discuss at length. As she talked about them, her third episode in 20 years, Jo Helen's mind was racing. Abruptly, Gloria asked her husband,
"Did you tell her about that pest control guy yesterday?"
"No, I forgot. I was on the golf course, and Gloria swears a pest control guy was in your house for at least an hour yesterday."
Again, preferring not to alarm them and provoke 100 other questions, Jo Helen said, "Oh, that's just the new guy, Freddy. He's got a key."
"Sure takes his time," Gloria said.
At the next opportunity, Jo Helen wiggled out of the conversation and said she was going to call the plumbing company and lodge a complaint. She said goodbye and crossed the street. She went straight to the burner, called Lacey, and reported in. Chapter 38. The current federal grand jury was convened at 1 p.m. on Friday, October 14th. When organized 4 months earlier, it had 23 members, all registered voters and otherwise duly qualified residents from the 6 counties that constituted Florida's Northern District. Serving was a demanding job, especially for citizens who didn't exactly volunteer. The pay was low, $40 a day, and their expenses were barely covered. However, the job was important and at times exciting, especially when the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office were on the trail of organized criminals. 17 were able to answer the bell on short notice, and since only 16 were needed for a quorum, they quickly got down to business. With the investigation growing by the hour, and with the rare possibility of indicting rich white men for capital murder, the U.S. attorney had seized control of the case. Her name was Paula Galloway, an Obama appointee and a veteran prosecutor. Her top assistant was Rebecca Webb, who by then knew more about the case than anyone but Ali Pacheco, who was called as the first witness. Since they had already indicted Zeke Foreman and Clyde Westbay, the grand jurors already knew the facts surrounding the death of Hugo Hatch. Allie recapped them quickly and answered a few questions from around the table. Ms. Galloway surprised them by calling as her next witness the driver himself. From the depths of the Fed's witness protection world, Zeke Foreman appeared and swore to tell the truth. Neither his plea agreement nor his whereabouts were to be discussed. He told his story, and the grand jurors were captivated by it. Since they had already indicted him, they seemed pleased with their decision and fascinated by his detailed account of the events of August 22nd. They asked a lot of questions, and Zeke handled himself well. He was relaxed, remorseful, and completely believable. Galloway, Webb, Pacheco, and the other FBI agents in the room watched him carefully. He would one day testify in court against the cousins, and their lawyers would attempt to annihilate him. The next witness was Clyde Westbay, who seemed to be at ease in the presence of the same federal grand jury that had indicted him for murder less than a week earlier. Clyde had just survived his first big test. A face-to-face chat with the boss himself while wearing a wire and snagging incriminating statements. For the first hour, Clyde discussed his role in the car crash. For the next 2 hours,
He talked about the DuBose organization and his part in it. He knew nothing of the skimming at the casino, but enthralled the grand jurors with his descriptions of laundering money at its blackjack tables. One juror, a Mr. Kraft from Apalachicola, confessed a fondness for blackjack and said he spent a lot of time at Treasure Key. He was fascinated by the laundering scheme and asked so many detailed questions that Ms. Galloway suggested they move along to more testimony. Late in the afternoon, Pacheco played the audio of Claude's conversation 8 hours earlier with Von DuBose. When Clyde was finished, after almost 5 hours of testimony, Ms. Galloway instructed the jurors on the applicable federal laws. The fact that the stolen truck crossed state lines meant the murder weapon was used in interstate commerce. The fact that Zeke was paid $5,000 for his role placed the crime squarely in the murder-for-hire category, thus a capital crime. And the fact that there was an organized criminal gang, and that one or more members of the gang did a crime that benefited the organization, meant all the gang members were subject to prosecution. It was almost 8 p.m. when the grand jury voted unanimously to indict Von DuBose, Hank Scully, Floyd Maton, Vance Maton, and Ron Skinner for the capital murder of Hugo Hatch and for the aggravated assault of Lacey Stoltz. Clyde Westbay was added as a defendant, though he would be dropped later. His plea agreement for first-degree murder would supersede the capital one. It was crucial for DuBose and the others to consider Clyde a co-defendant and still part of the team. Much later, they would learn of his agreement with the government. Lacey was at the stove, stirring the final ingredient, fresh mussels, into her version of chopino, an Italian fish stew that included scallops, clams, shrimp, and cod. The table was set, the candles lit, the sancerre on ice. Allie called as soon as he left the federal building 10 minutes away. She met him at the door with a proper but affectionate kiss. They were still kissing, but nothing more, at least in the physical sense. They were undoubtedly taking the full measure of one another and wondering what the future might hold. Lacey was neither physically nor emotionally ready for the next step, and there was no pressure from him. He seemed to adore her and was willing to wait. She poured wine as he took off his jacket and tie. The 18- and 20-hour days were adding up, and he was exhausted. Though grand jury proceedings were deeply secretive, he knew he could trust her. They were, after all, on the same team and understood confidentiality. The indictments were in place, sealed for now, but soon to be served as the FBI rounded up the gang. He didn't know exactly when, but arrests were imminent. Paula Galloway and the FBI had adopted the strategy of using two indictments. The first was the most urgent and important, and also the easiest. With the testimony of Zeke Foreman and Clyde Westbay, the case for murder was clear and the proof appeared to be beyond a reasonable doubt. Assuming DuBose and his boys had no idea what was coming, they would be arrested within days and locked away with no chance of bail. At the same time, the FBI would raid their homes and offices, along with those of Claudia McDover, Phyllis Turbin, Chief Kappel, Billy Kappel, and the lawyers in Biloxi who had represented DuBose for 20 years. Every business that had been identified so far as being part of the organization would be raided, and many of them closed temporarily. The casino would be swarmed by agents with search warrants. The U.S. attorney was trying to convince a federal judge to close it indefinitely. The second indictment, for racketeering, would include a wave of arrests that would be coordinated with the raids, with McDover getting top billing and perhaps the chief right behind her. Lacey said, "Myers liked to call it a RICO cluster bomb. That's what nailed him. And a pretty good description. It will be 2 inches thick. So, as DuBose is just finding his way around his jail cell and wondering how in the hell he got charged with murder, he'll be handed a little RICO gift.
He'll need 10 lawyers.
True, but he can't hire them. All of his accounts will be frozen.
Myers. Myers. I wonder where he is. I really liked the guy.
Well, I doubt if you'll see him again.
Will we ever know what happened to him?
I doubt it. The police in Key Largo have found nothing. It's a cold trail, and if DuBose was behind it, we'll probably never know. Unless one of his hitmen can be convinced to come clean.
She poured more wine. The grand jury would work tomorrow, Saturday, and Sunday if necessary.
The urgency was obvious. A protracted investigation with witnesses being hauled before the grand jury could cause a leak and tip their hand. Those who worked for the organization had the means and the expertise to disappear instantly.
Once the cousins were arrested for murder, their managers, errand boys, drivers, bodyguards, and couriers might feel the need to start running. After 8 days of intensive around-the-clock eavesdropping, the FBI had 29 names on its list of likely gang members.
"So you shoot first and ask questions later," Lacey said.
"Something like that. And keep in mind, we can always amend an indictment. We can always add or dismiss defendants. It's a massive investigation, and it'll take a long time to sort through it. But we plan to hit hard and get everybody locked up before they can tamper with evidence. I'm starving.
Did you have lunch?
No, I had a greasy burger from a drive-thru.
He tossed the salad as she scooped up the chopino and filled 2 bowls. This is a tomato sauce, so I'm thinking a red might be better. Do you have an opinion?
I'd go with red.
Good. Open that Barolo over there. She pulled a buttered baguette from the oven and served the salads. They sat across the table and sipped the wine. He said,
"Smells delicious. Thanks for waiting."
"I didn't really want to eat alone."
"You cook often?"
"No, there's no need." "Got a question for you."
"Fire away."
"At this point in the investigation, how does the informant figure into it?"
"Which informant?"
"The mole. The one close to McDover. The one feeding details to Cooley, who passed them on to Myers."
Allie chewed on a mouthful of salad and studied her face. "He's not important right now, but we'll need him later."
"He's a she, and she called me yesterday, really frightened. Someone broke into her house and went through her things. She sees McDover daily and thinks the judge is suspicious."
"Who is she?"
"I swore not to reveal her identity, at least not now. Maybe later. As I said, she's frightened and confused, and she doesn't know who to trust."
"She'll eventually be an important witness."
"I'm not sure she'll come forward."
"She may have no choice."
"But you can't make her testify."
"No, we can't. But there are ways to convince her. This stew is delicious."
He dipped a piece of bread into the broth and ate it with his fingers. "I'm glad you like it. So, are you working tomorrow?"
"Oh, yes. The grand jury convenes at 9. I have to be there at 8 for what should be another long day. Sunday as well."
"You guys always work like this?"
"No, but then we rarely get cases this big.
The adrenaline kicks in. Like this morning, when I was in the back of the van with 3 of our technicians, temperature about 120, and we listened to West Bay as he met with DuBose. That can really get your heart rate up there. It's a rush, and one of the reasons I love this job."
"How much can you tell me?"
Allie glanced around the kitchen as if spies were at hand.
"What do you want to know?"
"Everything. What did DuBose say?
It's beautiful.
Chapter 39 Lacey slept until almost 7 Saturday. A late hour for her, and even then wasn't ready to start the day. However, her dog, Frankie, was going through his usual early morning routine of sniffing and snorting and making sure she couldn't sleep because he needed to pee. She finally turned him out and went for the coffee beans. While it was brewing, her iPhone buzzed. Ali Pacheco, 7:02.
"Enjoy dinner," he said. "Sleep well?"
"Great. You?"
"No. Too much going on. Look, we picked up some chatter last night that is troublesome, to say the least. I don't suppose the informant you mentioned last night would be a court reporter?"
"Why?"
"Because if she's McDover's court reporter, then she's in danger. We're listening to a lot of phones right now, and I can't give you the exact language. It was in some goofy semi-code, but it appears as though the boss has given the order."
"She's the informant, Ali. Myers called her the Whistler."
"Well, they're on to her. Do you know where she is?"
"No."
"Can you contact her?"
"I'll try."
"Do that and call me back."
Lacey let the dog in and poured a cup of coffee. She picked up the burner and called Joe Helen's number. After the 5th ring, a timid voice said, "Is this Lacey?" "It is. Where are you?"
A long pause, then,
"What if someone is listening?" "No one is listening. No one knows about these phones. Where are you?"
"Panama City Beach. A cheap hotel, paid in cash. I'm looking at the ocean."
"I just spoke with the FBI. One of their wiretaps caught a conversation early this morning. They think you're in danger."
"I've been telling you that for 2 days.
"Stay in your room. I'll call the FBI."
"No, don't do that, Lacey. Cooley told me to never trust the FBI. Don't call them."
Lacey bit a nail and looked down at Frankie, who now wanted breakfast. "You have to trust them, Joe Helen. Your life is in danger."
The phone went dead. Lacey called twice, but with no answer. She quickly fed the dog, threw on some jeans, and left her apartment. Behind the wheel of her shiny new Mazda hatchback, which she'd bought 4 days earlier and was still trying to relax in, she called Ali and told him what was going on. He said that at the moment he was busy with the grand jury, but to keep him posted. Joe Helen finally answered the 5th call. She sounded terrified and refused to give Lacey the name of the hotel. Lacey knew that Panama City Beach was a busy strip of Highway 98, with dozens of small hotels packed together on the ocean side and fast food joints and t-shirt shops across the road.
"Why'd you hang up a while ago?" Lacey asked.
"I don't know. I'm scared, and I'm afraid someone is listening."
"The phones are safe. Keep the door locked, and if you see anything suspicious, call the front desk or the police. I'm on the way."
"You're what?"
"I'm coming to get you, Joe Helen. Just hang on. I'll be there in an hour or so." Delgado had a room on the 3rd floor next door at the West Bay Inn. She was at the Neptune. Both were low-end motels half filled with tourists from up north looking for bargains after the summer season. Her door opened onto a narrow concrete walkway on the 2nd level. The stairs were nearby. Beach towels and swimsuits hung to dry over the railings. But she had not been swimming. That would make it too easy for him. From 100 feet away, he watched her door and window. She had pulled her curtains tight, which had saved her life. With his sniper rifle, all he needed was a sliver. But so far, he had not had such an opening. So he waited, patiently. And as the hours passed Saturday morning, he thought of simply walking over and ringing her bell.
"Sorry, ma'am, wrong room."
Then he would kick the door open and it would be over in seconds. The obvious problem there was the chance of a short scream or shriek or other panicked noise that might attract attention. Just too risky. If she left the room, he would follow and wait for an opportunity, though he wasn't optimistic. The motels and cafes along the strip were far from deserted. There were just too many people around, and he didn't like the layout. He waited and wondered why she was hiding. Why hide if you're not afraid or guilty? What had happened to spook her enough to run away and pay cash for small rooms in cheap hotels? Her home was less than an hour away and was much nicer than these dumps. Perhaps the neighbors had seen him there as the pest control guy on Thursday. Perhaps that pesky man across the street told her how clumsy the plumber acted Friday morning. She knew she was guilty. And now she was paranoid. Delgado wondered if she was meeting a man, one she should not be meeting. But there was no sign of any hanky-panky. She was alone in there, just killing time, waiting for what? Sex was probably the last thing on her mind. A walk on the beach would be a sensible thing to do, or a swim in the ocean. Do what everyone else is doing and create some opportunities. But the door never opened, nor was she moving around, as far as he could tell. Pacheco said, "I don't like this, Lacey. You don't know what you're doing. Relax. Let the local cops handle it. Get the name of the hotel and call the cops." "She won't give me the name of the hotel, and she won't talk to the police. She's terrified, and she's not rational, Allie. She's hardly talking to me." "I can get two agents from our office in Panama City in a moment's notice."
"No, she's afraid of the FBI.
"That seems rather stupid, under the circumstances. How will you find her if you don't know where she is?"
"I'm hoping she'll tell me when I get there."
"Okay, okay. I have to get back to the grand jury. Call me in an hour."
"Will do."
She thought of calling Geismar for an update, but didn't want to disturb his Saturday. She was actually under orders to discuss any trips she might get the urge to take these days, but he was being overly protective. It was her day off, and she didn't feel like checking in. And where was the danger anyway? If she found Jo Helen, she would drive her away and find a safe place.
Jo Helen knew he was next door at the West Bay Inn, watching and waiting. He wasn't as clever as he thought. He had no idea she had seen him in her little home video, easing from one room to the next, getting his image stolen and recorded by her cameras as he admired her lingerie and picked through her files. A big man, at least 6'2", with a narrow waist and thick arms, and a slight limp to the left side. She had seen him just before sunrise walking across the motel parking lot with an odd-shaped bag. Even without his cute little pest control uniform, she knew it was the same man. She had called Cooley, but he did not answer. What a coward, a creep, a gutless liar who'd fled and left her all alone. She knew it was a waste of time to fixate on her former partner, but she was bitter. She had thought of calling Lacey, but she was in Tallahassee. What could she do anyway? So Jo Helen waited and tried to think clearly. Her speed dial was ready at 911 in case someone knocked on the door. At 9:50, the burner rang, and she grabbed it. "Hello, Lacey," she said as calmly as possible. "I'm on the strip. Where are you?"
"At a place called the Neptune Motel, across the street from a McDonald's." "What are you driving?"
"A red Mazda hatchback."
"Okay, I'll go to the front lobby and wait. Hurry."
Jo Helen slipped through her door and closed it quietly. She walked with a purpose but not a panic and descended the steps to the first floor. She crossed a courtyard and walked by the pool where an old couple was lathering on sunscreen.
In the lobby, she said hello to the clerk and stood near a window to watch the motel next door. Minutes passed. The clerk asked if she needed anything.
Sure. How about an assault rifle?
No thanks, she said.
When she saw a shiny red hatchback turn from the highway into the motel parking lot, she left through a side door of the lobby and walked to meet it. As she opened the door, she glanced over at the West Bay Inn. He was jogging along the third-level walkway, looking at her. But there was no way he could catch them.
"I assume you're Jo Helen Hooper," Lacey said as she closed the door.
"Yes, nice to meet you. He's coming. Get the hell out of here."
They turned onto Highway 98 and headed east. Jo Helen turned and watched the traffic behind them. Lacey asked,
"Okay, who is he?"
"Don't know his name. We haven't met, and I really don't want to. Let's lose him."
Lacey turned left at a busy light, then right at the next one. There was no sign of anyone giving chase. Jo Helen found a street map on her iPhone and navigated as they zigzagged out of Panama City Beach and headed north, away from the coast. The congestion thinned, as did the traffic. Lacey was flying, unafraid of any cops because at that moment they would be welcome. Still using the map, they turned either right or left on every country route and state highway. Both watched the road behind them and said little. After an hour, they crossed under Interstate 10, and half an hour later saw a sign welcoming them to Georgia.
"Any idea where we're going?"
Jo Helen asked.
"Valdosta."
"Who picked Valdosta?"
"I figured no one would expect us to go there. You been there?"
"Don't think so. You?"
"No."
"You look a lot different than your photo on that website. The one for BJC.
"I had hair back then,"
Lacey said. She had slowed to a reasonable speed. In the town of Bainbridge, they stopped at a fast food restaurant, used the restrooms, and decided to eat inside and watch the traffic. Both were convinced no one could have followed them. But they could not relax. They sat side by side near the front window, hunched over burgers and fries, and watched every car that passed on the highway. Lacey said,
"I have 1,000 questions.
I'm not sure I have that many answers, but give it a shot."
"Name, rank, and serial number, the basics."
43 years old, born in 1968 in Pensacola to a 16-year-old mother who was part Indian. A small part, not quite enough, it seems. Father was a tomcat who loved on the run. Never met him. I've been married twice, and don't think much of that arrangement now. You, Lacey?
Single. Never married.
Both were starving and ate quickly. Lacey asked, "The Indian thing, is that a factor in this story?"
"Yes, indeed. I was raised by my grandmother, a fine woman, and she was one half Indian. Her husband was a man with no blood, Indian or otherwise, so my mother was one-fourth. She claimed my father was one-half, but this couldn't be verified because he was long gone. I spent years trying to find him, not for any emotional or sentimental reason, but purely for money. If he is, or was, one-half, then I'm one-eighth."
"Tapacola, right?"
"Of course. And one-eighth gets you registered. A dreadful term, don't you think? We're supposed to register felons and sex offenders, but not real people with mixed blood. I fought with the tribe over my heritage, but simply didn't have enough proof. And, because of someone back there in my gene pool, I have these hazel eyes and lighter hair, so I don't look the part. Anyway, those in charge of racial classification eventually ruled against me, and I was denied entry to the tribe. Not that I was ever a real member."
"No dividends."
"No dividends. There are those with thinner bloodlines who've made the cut and live off the casino, but I got screwed."
"I haven't met many Tapacola,
But you certainly don't look the part.
Jo Helen was an inch or two taller than Lacey, thin and fit in tight jeans and tight blouse. Her large hazel eyes twinkled even when she was worried. Her face was free from wrinkles or any hint of aging. She wore no makeup and didn't need it.
Thanks, I guess. My looks have caused me nothing but trouble.
Lacey stuffed the last bite of her cheeseburger in the bag and said, "Let's get out of here." She drove east on Highway 84, with one eye on the road behind her and with little traffic to worry about. She stayed within the speed limits. And she listened. Not surprisingly, Cooley was not his real name, and Jo Helen never revealed it. She had met him almost 20 years earlier when her first marriage broke up. He had a small office in Destin and a decent reputation as a divorce lawyer. Her first husband was a heavy drinker and physically abusive, and she became a big fan of Cooley's when he protected her during an altercation at his office. She was meeting him there to discuss matters when her husband barged in, drunk and looking for trouble. Cooley pulled out a gun and got rid of him. The divorce went off smoothly, and her ex disappeared. Before long, Cooley, who was himself divorced, called to check on her. They dated off and on for several years, with neither willing to commit. He married someone else, another bad choice, and she made the same mistake. Cooley handled her second divorce, and they resumed their dating games. He was a good lawyer who could have been much better if he had stayed away from the dark side. He loved to handle sleazy divorces and criminal cases that involved drug dealers and bikers. He hung out with shadier men who ran strip clubs and bars along the panhandle. It was inevitable that his path would cross with that of Von DuBose. They never did business, and Cooley told her more than once that he'd never met DuBose. But he was envious of his organization. 15 years ago, Cooley heard the rumor that the Coast Mafia was involved with the Indians and their proposed casino. He wanted some of the action, but was sidetracked when the feds nailed him for tax evasion. He lost his license and went to prison, and there he met one Ramsey Mix, another fallen lawyer and his future partner in crime. She was unaware of the name of Greg Myers until she saw it on the complaint filed against Claudia McDover. Cooley and Jo Helen were much too frightened to sign a complaint and accuse her boss of wrongdoing. It was his idea to find a third person to do so, someone who would run the risk for a nice piece of the action. She was curious about Myers, so Lacey told her stories. Their first meeting on his boat in the marina in San Augustine. His little Mexican friend, Carlita. Their second meeting in the same place. Their third meeting for lunch at Mexico Beach. His surprise visit to her apartment after she was injured. His disappearance in Key Largo, and their rescue of Carlita. According to her source at the FBI, the investigation into this disappearance was going nowhere. Lacey wanted to know whom they were running from, who was back there at the motel watching her. Jo Helen didn't know his name, but she had him on video. Lacey stopped at a country store near the town of Cairo, and on Jo Helen's iPhone watched part of the video of a man combing through her apartment. Jo Helen explained that Cooley was a whiz with electronics and gadgets and had installed the cameras. He was also the guy who stuck a GPS monitor on the inside of the rear bumper of Claudia's Lexus, and he also rented a condo across the street and took photos and videos of her and Vaughn coming and going on the first Wednesday of each month. What happened to Cooley? Jo Helen wasn't sure, but she was angry. This entire operation was his idea. He knew enough about Von DuBose and the casino. He and Jo Helen had been intimate, on and off, for many years, and he preyed on her resentment toward the tribe. He convinced her to apply for a job as McDover's court reporter when she fired her old one 8 years earlier. Once she was in place as a state employee, they had a clear path to recovery under the whistleblower statute. He knew the law and dug through the cases and filings and rulings and became convinced